Welcome back. Our guest tonight is an Emmy-nominated writer, producer, actor, and the genius.
Please welcome Dan Levy.
Welcome to a very delicious episode of LevyCast. I'm your host, Dan Levy. Once again, I promise everybody a different kind of a podcast every time I start these things. You never know what you're going to get from me, and this time, this one is going to be delicious. I have with me 13-time James Beard Award-winning food reporter in TV, radio, podcasts. He's an author. He used to be on ABC 7, now NBC 5. He's also the founder and curator at Pizza City Fest. Ladies and gentlemen, the Hungry Hound, do we even still call him that? Steve Dolinsky.
We can't say that anymore. Disney owns the IP, so we're now known as the food guy.
Gotcha. Well, then we'll scrap that for the special feature for everybody to know. He used to be the Hungry Hound. The way I got introduced to you, to be honest, I'm not from Chicago. And the way I got introduced to you, I came out here to do radio and to do media stuff. And I got introduced to you because every time I went to a hot dog place, a Portillo's, I saw your face. I saw like a headshot of you. And I was like, oh my God, I've got to meet this guy. This guy is doing everything that I want to do for a living and more. And I'm sure that is something you hear probably every day.
Yeah, I always hear you've got the greatest job in the world. And how do I become your assistant? And if you need, somebody to carry your bags, we're happy to help out. It's been a really interesting path in Chicago. I just celebrated 30 years in Chicago. So I'm originally from Minnesota.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Time has just flown by. And as you said, I was at ABC for a long time. And so, literally, I was coming back from Europe earlier this week. And the first woman that greeted me after I got through TSA or through the passport control was, oh, my God, Hungry Hound. Great to see you. So I understand that branding has some, importance in Chicago, but I always tell people really, really respectfully, we had to put the hound to sleep. It was a very sad day, but honestly, that 5 months in between was great. And when NBC called me and wanted to start up kind of the same thing, I was just over the moon. So it's been about a year and a half now at NBC and can't say enough good things about those people.
I've done some stuff in and out of that building, and I know those NBC guys, and they are pretty awesome. I do enjoy a lot of those people over there. I did want to touch on you because I actually did research for once on a guest. This one's new for me to actually research somebody, but with you, I was like, I want to try to pretty much touch all bases. You are from Minneapolis or St. Cloud, and you grew up, which was surprising me, in a kosher home. I did too.
Yes.
I also grew up in a very Jewish kosher home growing up. My parents, they met in Israel, both in New York, and we were very kosher. I mean, it was to the point where, if I actually mixed a meat spoon with a milk spoon, we had it buried outside. I mean, we had different dishes for Passover. I mean, the whole nine yards. I grew up in a very Jewish household. And just like you, how did you bust the kosher mold?
It was very similar. We never buried the stuff outside, but we did have four sets of silverware, right? We had milchig and fleishig, milk and meat. And then during Passover, you had to have the same separation.
Yes.
So, yeah, my folks were old school. My mom was from Minneapolis. My dad was from St. Cloud. But he and his father had a scrapyard, which was what immigrant Jews did in the 1930s and 40s. Auto parts, scrap, rags, what have you. So that was my dad's business for many years in St. Cloud. But to bust out of that mold, it was tough. To be honest, we had no pork, we had no shellfish, we had no milk and meat ever. We would wait for the Greyhound buses to come from Minneapolis because it was about an hour to St. Cloud once a week to deliver the kosher Empire frozen chicken
that
we kept in our basement. So, and my mom was not a good cook. I've interviewed her over the years about this. It was more about sustenance than it was about pleasure.
Got it.
But the thing that, I wore her down over time. I remember my senior year in high school, I was able to bring in a Domino's pepperoni pizza if I put it on paper plates, as long as it didn't touch anything that we could dispose of. That was important. So, but I had, this was the key for me was the pivot point was really my brother's girlfriend who became his wife, my future sister-in-law, she was from Tasmania. And she was a world traveler and was really into food and cooking. And so when they started dating, and I would go over to their house, probably junior high school, maybe in early high school, exposed me to the world of Szechuan shrimp and, noodles from different places around the world. And so I'd never had this kind of food before. And that really sort of a light bulb went off, like, what have I been missing my whole life? And I kind of feel like that's partly why I'm in this career, trying to make up for lost time, even though I've gone way beyond that now. But I feel like I missed so many experiences as a kid. We Christmas Eve, we'd have Chinese food, but we couldn't have, sweet and sour pork, obviously. But eventually I got into that. And I think, my friends in college in Madison in Wisconsin always made fun of me. Like, I was, there's a funny part in the movie Diner where Earl orders the left side of the menu.
Yeah.
And they always call me Earl because I'm the guy ordering the left side of the menu because I want to try everything. And so that kind of set the stage for my career. I was always interested in food. Even when I was doing news reporting in Upper Michigan and in the Quad Cities, I was always trying to find that interesting Thai place or, deli. And that just sort of led to, it just kept building and building until I got to Chicago.
When you were going through your kosher phase and you're like, if I ever ate something else, what was it for you? What was the thing that you're like, I can't wait to try this? Because I remember having pepperoni for the first time. That was probably my bust, was at a school lunch. And I remember trying pepperoni on a pizza and I was like, that is not everything I thought it would be. And then I had sausage on a pizza and I was like, that is everything I thought it was going to be.
That's such a Chicago thing.
And I wasn't even in Chicago at the time. I was in Connecticut.
Oh, that's interesting. I was interested in seafood, like lobster, shrimp, because you see shrimp a lot in Chinese menus, and I can never have that. The pork I wasn't as interested in. This is a very small world department. So in Chicago, you'll know there's a place called the Twisted Spoke.
Oh, God, I love that place.
So we don't live very far from there. It turns out the founder, the owner, co-owner, Mitch Einhorn, was my brother's friend at the university or Denver University in college, like in the late 70s. They went to school together. And so my brother brought Mitch back to St. Cloud for a visit. And Mitch tells me this story years later that we went to a Chinese restaurant and he was, of course, eating the pork and the sweet and sour pork and gave me some to try and remembers seeing my face light up.
Wow.
What is this? What is this pork you're having? The sweet and sour pork. And so, fast forward 30 plus years, I'm in Chicago, and he's got a place called the Twisted Spoke, and it was just so funny to reconnect with him over that. But yeah, for me, seafood was the kind of the forbidden fruit, but eventually, pork and sausage, and just like you, when I had sausage on a pizza, it changed my life.
And I remember in high school, I was sneaking around with my buddies. We'd all go out, and most kids, like when they were in high school, and I got a card, I had a debit card. And I remember most of my friends were going out drinking and doing all kinds of things. And I was like, let me try everything at Taco Bell tonight. Everything my parents won't let me try. And then after this, we're going to go to Burger King. And after this, we're going to go to a Chinese buffet. And I was like, I was the same way. I was like, I cannot wait. And then once it turned, I remember my mom at one point just saying, just try to eat kosher at the house. I was like, you got yourself a deal.
That was it. Same deal. All the Jewish mothers of a certain age made that deal.
Yes. At first, there was a lot of trouble, and we don't do that. And then it was, if you could, just bring kosher home.
But the other part of that was not just so much the sort of trying things I was forbidden from having at home, but for me, it was more about exploring these cultures.
Yes.
That's kind of what I really get excited about. So, living in St. Cloud, it's very Swedish, very Scandinavian. I mean, moving to Minneapolis, everybody I went to high school with was Svensson, Jorgensen, Johansson, all the Swedes. So
awesome.
Very limited diet. It was meatballs, it was potatoes, it was super limited, and plus you're in the upper Midwest. For me, food was this escape. It was a passport. It was a way to get out of my upbringing, and it was a way to explore cultures. And so, like, when I moved to Chicago in end of 92, I lived above the King Crab on Halsted.
Oh, I know. I remember that place. That's a great place.
It's a great place. I remember working my way out in concentric circles along Halsted and all those neighborhoods and, like, going to Uncle Tenu's and Ito Sushi and some Thai place up the street, Bantai. Just really fascinated with all these different cultures. in one place. So that for me was like my ticket out of boredom or out of routine.
I moved out to Chicago myself. I moved around a lot as a kid. I told you I went to, grew up mostly in the East Coast, New York, Connecticut, and then went to high school in Omaha, Nebraska. And then I came out to Chicago to do this, and my brother was already living here, and he's got buddies and a fraternity, and they all have different cultures and backgrounds. So when I moved out here, there was all the Mexican friends that were showing me all the good. When I went to the first Mexican restaurant out here, it was after a basketball game, and I was used to Taco Bell burritos, and I wasn't that hungry. We would just play basketball, and I was like, you know, what do you want? I'm like, I guess I'll just get a burrito. And they brought this freaking monstrous burrito to me, and I was like, the hell is this? And they're like, that's a burrito. I'm like, I'm used to those little tiny rolls that you get at like Taco Bell where I can slam like three at a time while driving. So I had that for the first time. And then a buddy of mine, his family owns all the Joy Yee restaurants in Chinatown and all of those areas. So he was living with my brother at the time, and he introduced me to Asian culture to extremes I never thought I would ever try. And I loved every bit of it. And it's almost gotten to the point where I was telling my wife, and I when I was doing overnights, I got introduced to Andrew Zimmern and back in 2006 and was watching all of his unique foods and those kinds of those programs. I remember saying to myself, I'm not grossed out by any of these things. And my palate and appetite has almost gotten to the point where I said, I will almost try anything as long as it's not human. Like I'm down to try. I would love to do the traveling. And I remember we once had Anthony Bourdain when I was working for ManCow back in the day. He came in and he tried to gross me out with some chicken feet. It was just boiled chicken feet. And I was like, that I really want something, man. Give me something that'll actually like sting my lips. Give me like a blowfish. I want to try it, whatever it is. I'm game.
Yeah, I'm not as adventurous. I mean, I've eaten all over the world. You know, the blowfish to me, the entrails, the intestines, the offal is called, doesn't excite me as much. I've been to St. John in London, which is a place that relishes or nose to tail cooking. Fergus Henderson wrote the book Nose to Tail Eating, actually. I have a hard time with like the texture. I get gout if I eat a lot of the offal, the odd bits, the extremities, the kidney, the heart, the lung. So I'm not able to eat that. Gotcha. Sweetbreads is another thing I'm not really supposed to eat. Because it exacerbates that, and that is the worst.
Wow, a food guy with eating preferences. This is awesome. This is interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So you'll never see me do stories about like heart, lung, ear. although I did do a talk. I did La Chaparita in Pilsen, in Little Village, and they cook with tripe. But they have other things too. So yeah. It's nice to have the option. But yeah, I'm not as like, I could never do Zimmern's job. I could never do bizarre foods. The travel part excites me, but you've got to be polite when you're in somebody's home or in their kitchen or in their restaurant. And so you can't just push it aside. You've really got to try everything.
You got to try everything. When I remember when he said the camel foot was the one he couldn't do. And I was like, oof, I'm not sure I'd be able to do that one either. I remember that was like that. You and I would probably have to put my foot down for that
Rocky
one.
Rocky Mountain oysters. You had Rocky Mountain oysters?
I have. They are delicious. No, can't do it. I guess that I've been in unique situations, but I've not done the traveling. I've not done the, I'm going to go travel to eat. I've kind of 20 years in radio. It only kind of allows me to do certain things. I don't get to travel as much as I would like to and really venture out. But everything that you got to do, I've kind of gone, you go to a lot of the high-ender stuff, which I do love to try to get out and do. Now that I feel like now the last 10 years, Chicago has really become like you can either go for the low kind of joints or the hot dogs, the gyros, the Italian beefs, or if you want to go like Michelin star, you can really find those kinds of places. And then whenever I do those kinds of places, I feel like I need to do more research on each one of those because I can go to any hot dog stand and be, okay, this is awesome. But if you're going to go to like and spend some real money, I feel like I need to like research who the chef is, what are they specialized in? Because you don't want to spend that kind of money and have someone go, oh, you ordered the wrong thing. You should have ordered the steak tartare or something like that.
Yeah, when you're at one of those places, though, I always feel like there should not be such a thing as ordering wrong because everything should be at such a high level. Everything
you're right.
Should be good.
You're right.
I struggle with this all the time. Like, should I be covering the hot dog, the beef joints, which we have in spades here, or should I be going to more higher end? I try to really be cognizant of that balance, city versus suburbs, high end, low end. I went to a tasting menu last night. I just popped into a new Indian tasting restaurant. It used to be, you remember Graham Elliott restaurant? It's been many things, but it's over on West Huron.
Oh, and yeah. That was the sandwich place, right? It used to be a sandwich Graham Elliott spot?
No, his sandwich place was on State Street.
That Grahamwich's, which I liked.
Right, but his upscale place was on Huron.
Gotcha.
So anyway, it's now called Indian, and well-regarded chef, worked at Rue. I love Rue. I did probably a 6-course tasting menu last night. Underwhelmed. I mean, I ended up spending, I got a glass of wine with tax and tip, was about $137.
Whoa.
I wouldn't recommend going there. It was too much money. It wasn't really exciting. And disappointing. But, you know, am I going to write a story about that? Am I going to blog about it? Am I going to post pictures of it? No. I just feel like, why do I need to go there? I want to talk about and promote the places I like.
Gotcha. How does somebody right now, especially you, and I know I'll say this about you too, you also do media training and you also teach people how to, if they want to go ahead and do what you do for a living, you can coach them and that the service that you offer. I feel like it's such a saturated market right now. Everybody wants to do food. Everybody wants to taste. Everybody's a foodie. And I always say to myself, I think foodies are I don't know what I am. I'm not a foodie. I'm a person who's overweight and I love food. I'm a person who goes to the gym now just so I can have the food. I think a foodie should look like me. Most people that are really skinny, like I'm a foodie. I like the little things. I'm like, I can eat everything.
Yeah, I hear you on that. And I'm just going to correct one thing. People in the food industry absolutely hate the word foodie.
Good.
So
I as well.
That term. I would say food enthusiast. I would say food lover. I would say somebody who is passionate about eating. But that term foodies jumped the shark.
Thank you.
That said, you're right. There's a lot of people on Instagram who you know, fancy themselves food critics or food writers or not even food writers, but just like they're food fanatics or they're influencers. I try to stay away from that. Like I really try to emphasize the fact that, you know, I have a dining budget. NBC allows me to go try places and so that I don't have to feel like I have to cover them, right? I don't have to go to press dinners and freebies and accept comps from people like a lot of people do. And you'll see it kind of buried the bottom of their posts, you know, hashtag partnership, hashtag collaboration, hashtag ad. So you don't see that on mine. I go to places, I try them out. If I like it, you'll see it on my feeds. If I don't like it, like last night's experience, you're not going to see it. I'm not a food critic necessarily.
I get that.
I'm trying to be a food reporter.
That's even better because you're in a spot where you're only going to tell the people that you like stuff. So that makes you even a better person because you know no one's going to spit in your food, and you don't know anyone's going to be like, that guy's going to make or break my my restaurant. If you like it, you like it. If you're not, you're not going to talk about it. That's actually, I think, the better place to be sitting when it comes to stuff like that.
Oh, for sure. I'm just like, it's tough right now. It's so saturated, as you said. There's so many people trying to do what we do. I feel like I just got to separate myself, and so. I'm kind of doing what I've been doing for 30 years. You know, I'm a food reporter. I'm trying to find places. I'm trying to tell people about it. I'm trying to educate people a little bit. Just sort of boil down Chicago, you know, to its essence so that you can like not waste a lot of time looking through a lot of junk and Yelp and you know, things you can't really trust. And just like, hey, I vetted this for you. Trust me.
How did you do it? How did you go to the food? How did one actually break out into a career where you can tell these people, I want you to start giving me money so I can try these restaurants and I can be this person for your television station.
How did that begin?
Yeah. How did that career path even go? Because I've tried going in the food route and every time I've even gone there, it's oversaturated. Too many people do it. How did you bust into that?
So it was right place, right time. I was a news reporter at CLTV. I came to Chicago in 92 to be a news reporter here. Did not like news coverage. I mean, really, I don't have a thick skin for that. So, covering fires and shootings, but I like the storytelling part of it. And I like, you know, gathering video and putting a story together at the end of the day and being able to communicate something, you know, in a couple of minutes. So you take that sort of love of the professional side of it, the technical side of it, and then you combine it with my love of food. As I said, by the time I got to Chicago, I'd been, you know, eating for several years, devouring half the menu at these restaurants, trying all these different things. So 2 years into my job at CLTV, they said, we're going to launch a TV show called Good Eating, based on the Tribune's revamped food section called Good Eating. And they wanted somebody to produce a weekly half hour show. So I volunteered to do that. We had a host who was our weather guy, and the show took off and we won a Beard Award. And then the host quit to take a job in another market. And then I took over as the host and the producer. So we did that show for a total of 6 years. We did 52 shows a year. We never did a rerun because the food section was always new every Wednesday.
Awesome.
And so it was, you know, but that also let me start reaching out to public radio in Chicago and doing food contributing food stories for 8:48 in the morning there with Steve Edwards. I started pitching stories to the Chicago Reader, you know, anything that I could do to sort of
promote it,
raise my game, right, and learn about food. I was in my late 20s, early 30s. So, and then when they canceled Good Eating in 03, I was like, hey, what am I going to do now? I mean, there's nobody covering food on television in Chicago. There was this guy, James Ward, who was the restaurant critic at ABC 7 on Friday nights at 10 o'clock. Wasn't really a critic per se. It was more of a personality, but he had his shtick Friday nights. But I ended up going to ABC because they were expanding. This is, again, right place, right time. They happened to be expanding their 11 a.m. newscast from a half hour to an hour because Port Charles, the soap opera, was getting canceled. And so when I reached out to all the news directors in town, by the time I reached out to ABC, they said, hey, we'd love to have you maybe twice a week doing a food story. So that awesome. Started the Hungry Hound. That was in 03. And we did two stories a week, and then it got up to four stories a week, and then down to two stories a week. But I did that for 17 years. And again, while I was doing that, doing a lot of freelance and just kind of always hustling and always doing side hustles, because
that's the
not
game.
Necessarily a full-time job. That's the gig.
That's, you know, the game, yeah.
Stuff. So doing media training outside of Chicago, teaching chefs how to be on television, curating experiences for people, putting together food tours, food trips, did a couple food tours to Havana, did one to New Orleans. So really,
I want in on one of these. I want in on one of these.
Yeah. And so it just kind of, it just like snowball. You're like, the more you do it, the more you make connections, the more you get invited to be a moderator at the Aspen Food and Wine Classic, you know, every year. You get invited to be a moderator here. I'm going to be a moderator for an event in Miami. That's a food, you know, so anytime there's a food event where they want somebody who's sort of a food
credible
reporter, expert, you know, a
credible yeah. person.
It's
yeah.
Not just, I don't just post pictures of bubble tea, you know, that's not my thing. But no, so it just, right, I think the longer I was at ABC, just sort of build my reputation. And then, but when I left there and I was like, uh-oh, what am I going to do? Nobody in Chicago is covering food. They canceled the Chicago's Best show. They canceled Check Please on public television. I'm like, boy, now there's really nothing going on.
Right.
And out of the blue, you know, because Kevin Cross, you have a new GM over at NBC, came from the programming side, came from sports. He really believed in food coverage, and that was one of his first priorities, was to sign me up. So I was just, you know,
over awesome. Let me dig in real quick with you. As far as, I watch a lot of those Food Network channels. I think we all have. I actually do podcast. I'm a producer of podcast for a bunch of different people. One of the persons is Food Network star Jeff Morrow. I was doing some stuff with his podcast, and I've been watching Food Network and those kind of shows forever. Since you're doing the media training and stuff, what do you make of all the people that are out there trying to do food shows and all that stuff? Is there somebody who does it the best out there in terms of doing a food show or hosting a food show? What are the keys for people that want to start doing it that you teach people? Like, what are some basic foundation stuff people need to know when they start kind of going into that game of, I want to be a television food personality?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's mostly about personality. You know, it's really, you don't need to have a ton of experience. You should know what you're talking about. I mean, you should know how to cook. You should have some recipes. You should know, like, you've tested recipes before, or you're a home cook who just really has strong cooking skills. But it's mostly about personality. When you're doing television, when you're doing videos, and a lot of times now people don't even need a TV show. They're just doing what do you call it? They're just doing TikTok videos, or they're doing live stream stuff, or Facebook. You've got to engage the viewer. You've got to pull them in, and you've got to keep them. And so I always tell people, like, don't create some kind of a fake persona. You know, you're not going to be Emeril. You know, I don't want you bamming But I want you to be engaging and personable and share something about yourselves with people to ingratiate yourself with the audience. You know, it's not like, you know, I'm a professional and you're not. It's about, hey, this was my struggle coming up with this Basque cheesecake. This is a common pitfall. You know, this might happen to you too, but if you just stick with me, you know, you're going to get through this. So you sort of make it, you've got to make it conversational, and you can't talk down to people like, you know, I'm the expert and you're not. That's an important thing. But I think it's really important to have a good personality, to be able to be smooth. Like, you know, one of the things I learned from doing live television, you know, these live shots, he'd send you out, you know, there's a car accident on the highway, you're live at 6, you know, and I did that for years in the Quad Cities and in Chicago for a while. That trains you to so go out there and be live and talk without a net, because you have to be able to do it without a safety net. And that's what separates people. I think when you see a lot of times people who've done some reporting in the past and then they go out and try to do other things, it really helps them become good public speakers.
I understand that. I've been doing a lot of radio. I mean, radio for me did it all. It crafted a lot of my my improvisation and that kind of stuff. So I've noticed that. I do traffic reporting. I do news reporting. I do some sports. I do commercials. I do a lot of different stuff. So I've noticed that when I've got a lot of live stuff. I used to do traveling on BBM. There's an accident. We're going to throw it to you right now. And then, like you said, there's no real time to script it. You just got to be it and be authentic about it. That rings true. What also rings?
I would say you certainly got the pipes to do radio. I can tell.
But I want to expand. I want to do so much more. I want to be food. I want to be everything. But that's, like you said, it's, you know, sometimes you're, you know, life kind of figures out different ways and different paths for you. I used to do telemarketing when I was 16, not knowing what I was going to do for a living. And then I was doing telemarketing in Omaha and I was selling credit cards to low income people and I hated the job. So I tried to get myself almost fired. And instead of getting fired, my boss brought me in and said, your voice is too good. You should try radio when you graduate high school. And I went, all right, I'll try that. And 20 years later in Chicago, I've kind of just kept on this path. So
it does, but it's important to do all these experiences and make connections. Because I've found that, you know, later in life, like these connections have come back in positive ways. I remember having coffee with Frank Whitaker, the news director at NBC, 10 years ago, when I thought, it might have been during the recession, I thought they were going to cut the Hungry Hound. I thought they were going to get rid of food coverage because they were cutting back on everything. And I was kind of scared, and I met with him, and he said, you know, honestly, if we had the money, we'd probably hire a producer or a camera operator. Food is not important to us right now. But I stayed in touch with him. I mean, look what happened 10 years later. He ends up calling me. Are you interested in coming over here for a job? So man. I think a lot of it is, you know, you've got to build your reputation. You've got to stay in touch with people. You've got to be a hustler. Nothing ever falls in people's laps. I hate when people say, well, I'm going to just hang out and do this job for a while and see if something comes my way. Nothing's going to come your way, you know, unless you are
grinding. You got to grind. I agree with you.
Like in television, you know, I could say unless you're like a stunning, you know, Asian American or a Korean woman, you know, there aren't a lot of Asian. I just read a story this morning. There's like 24% of the TV stations in the country have zero Asian American Pacific Islander reporters on the air. So if you were, you know, Asian American and you were interested in this career and you were telegenic, I would really encourage you to go out and start, you know, working and being in television, because you're going to have opportunities down the road in these major markets. They're dying to hire people. There are too many white guys who look like us. There's a lot of demand for diversity right now.
Right, right.
So I tell people, like, in fact, I've got one of my mentees, African-American girl from Chicago, goes to Xavier University in Louisiana, in New Orleans. She's interested in food, and I'm really encouraging her right now to go down this path, because there's no one that looks like her doing what we're doing. You mentioned Andrew Zimmern. I mean, you know, another bald, middle-aged Jewish guy. Like, you know, there needs to be some diversity here.
Sure. Well, I totally agree with all that. Let me get you on a couple things, because I know your time is valuable and I got to get running here myself, and I could talk to you for hours. Let me get some quick hints out of you. Pizza City Fest. That is your thing. You're a curator of it. You're the founder of it. Pizza snob. What is your perfect slice of pizza?
Perfect slice is an artisan slice, which means a long fermentation, a thin pizza cut into wedges that I can fold on the heel like a New York slice. But it's typically very homemade toppings, you know, small batch producers, but it's mostly about the crust. Pizza to me is always about the crust. So a 3-day fermentation, high hydration dough. In Chicago, it would be Roberts. In New York, it would be La Industry or Best. But I like that style of pizza.
I have just recently become a connoisseur of crispy pepperonis. The pepperoni needs to have a crisp and be on top, and I've not been able to find that.
It's called cup and char. So because they have a natural casing, and so as they bake, they curl up, and the outside rim gets charred, but the cup holds the
so
juices
good.
And render, the fat. Delicious. You can find those at Pauly G's Slice Shop in Wicker Park. You can find them at Pauly G's in Logan Square. You can find them at Zaza's up in Lakeview. Several places
awesome.
Have cup and char.
When it comes to pizza, how are you about a pizza puff? I think that is the one food in Chicago that is so underrated and nobody talks about, and I've only found it here, and it probably is my favorite Chicago item that nobody talks about.
There's a chapter of it in my new book, by the way. Their main office is 4 blocks from my house in Westtown. Great story, by the way. Immigrant story, Illinois Tamale Company, which got shortened to Il Taco. In the 70s, all the hot dog joints were getting crushed by the pizzerias that were opening up. Because you got to remember, 71 was the watershed year. Lou Malnati's, Mai Pai, Pequod's, Nancy's. And so all these places are doing pizza. The hot dog joints ask their tamale company supplier, could you come up with something to help us compete? They create the pizza puff.
So good.
Which is basically pizza fillings in a tortilla shell that you can drop in a deep fryer and make
so
a
good.
Pizza puff.
So good.
I'm not a huge fan of that. It's great drunk food, late night food, I think, to soak up alcohol. But it's not my go-to typically when I walk into a place.
I every time I go to a new place, I judge it on how good either the hot dog or hamburger or gyro are, one of those. And I also have to do a pizza puff just because that's like, I know it's like the same place. I think it's the same manufacturer that gives everybody the same pizza puffs. But I'm always like, I even got my 8-year-old son on it. He's like, I don't know if I want to try it. I go, eat it. And he's like, I want to eat that. I'm like, it's the best one. For me, it's the best. I love a good pizza puff. Drunk or not.
There's one manufacturer. Yeah, there's one place, Il Taco does all the pizza puffs in Chicago.
You and I both not being from Chicago. When were you introduced to the fact that you're not allowed to put ketchup on your hot dog? And do you follow that still?
I do. Early on in my experience, I did a story for public radio with Bruce Craig, a historian at Roosevelt University. And we talked about it then. So I knew this 15, 20 years ago. I never was a fan of ketchup on a hot dog anyway. And I agree that it's too sweet. You don't need that sweetness and high fructose corn syrup on a perfectly steamed hot dog with natural casing. I just think mustard is a much better companion. And so I adhere to it. I preach it. I do make fun of people who put ketchup on. I think you can't call yourself a Chicagoan if you put ketchup on it.
No.
I think it's a little sad if you're over 9 or 10 years old and you put ketchup on your hot dog.
My thing is, I agree with you. I've learned to not like it because on the East Coast, ketchup and mustard is the toppings. You get onions, ketchup, and mustard. So when I came out here, I got my hand slapped a lot. And I'm always like, all right, we're running it through the garden, and ketchup is the one that's not allowed. I've never had relish on anything else before in my life. And suddenly that boots ketchup. So it makes me laugh that relish lives well in Chicago.
And there are tomatoes on a Chicago hot dog.
Right?
It's one of the 7 condiments would be tomatoes too. So
you're right.
Unless you go to Superdog, there'd be pickled green tomatoes, not red ones.
Yes. Most overrated ingredient for me, I see it being the truffle. Whenever I've gone to places and people say, I've had my wife's nephew came one of these parties, he spent like $100 on this little ounce of a truffle. He came and he shaved it onto my plate, and I tried it with a sauce he made. I'm like, I don't taste anything. I don't taste mushroom. Too overrated for me.
And I agree with you, and funny that you mentioned that, because my dinner I had last night had 2 courses with Burgundy black truffles on them, which I just don't think added anything to the dish. But you've got to be specific with that. I do think white truffles from Alba are magic.
Ooh.
Because it's mostly about the aroma, and the aroma is so pervasive, and it does bump up the experience quite a bit, and they're expensive. But black truffles, I think, are the most overrated. I also think uni, sea urchin, is a little bit overrated.
That's the one I have not tried that one yet. I would like to, because I always see it on these food shows, and I'm like, it looks, everyone's like, it's so sweet, it's so good, but I've never heard anybody say it's overrated. I like it.
I think it's a little overrated. Yeah.
Gotcha. The Italian beef, I think, in my opinion, my honest and humble opinion, is the overrated item. I find it to be just a beef sandwich dunked in gravy and meat sweat. For me, it needs like a cheese. I was at my wife's sister's house. I put on some Caesar salad dressing on it. For me, it needs a little bit more. I find it to just be too, this is Chicago. This is how we eat it. Eat some hot peppers with it. I'm always like, oh, Italian beef, until I put something on it. But everyone's like, that's not a real Italian beef.
No. Let me unpack that for just one second. So that statement, so when you're saying that, have you been to Johnny's in Elmwood Park or Bob O's on West Irving?
I've not been to Bob O's, but I've been to the other one.
Johnny's.
Yes.
Okay.
And I used to live right on Taylor Street. Al's Italian beef was out of my window.
That doesn't make a difference to me. If you've been to Johnny's and you're still going to make that statement, then okay. I mean, I got to respect that. But I think like a proper, you know, beef, sweet, hot, juicy from Johnny's is still, it's almost like mother's milk to me. I had it early in my Chicago experience in like 93, 94. And it's been very consistent, even though they've changed the bread recently. I'm a big fan of that style. I don't think it needs cheese. I think that's what they do in Philadelphia. But I do like it if it's properly dipped and there's enough seasoning in that gravy and the jardinera is just, you know, made just so. I don't like the hunks of green bell pepper.
Yes.
When you order a sweet at most places. That's a waste.
I agree with you.
And it's finely chopped onions and pepper, which is what it should be, sort of evenly spread throughout the sandwich. But I can see where you're coming from. I mean, there's been a lot of interest in the beef since The Bear aired on Hulu.
Yes.
A lot of questions about that. Yours truly did have a 2-second cameo on the wall of the restaurant. They asked for my headshot.
So nice.
Very, very important to have.
It wouldn't be a hot dog joint if your head wasn't on there.
Right. But I do think when people do tell me that, I'm like, well, go to Johnny's and then say the same thing. So you've done that.
I went to Johnny's early on in my Chicago when I first moved out here in my 20s. I'll have to try that one again because I've been meaning it. I always ask people, what's your favorite beef place? And they're always like, oh, there's Tony's on 87. There's this place. There's that place. Every time I'm like, it's the same to me. But I will retry that one.
I did a roundup several years ago. It's probably Googleable. 31 beefs in the city, which took me about a month and a half. Horrible assignment. I don't know why I decided to do it. But I wanted to sort of get to the bottom once and for all. And Johnny's, and there's another place in Homer Glen called the Original Mr. Beef. And
I'm right by Homer Glen.
Really?
Yeah, I'm in Orleans, so yeah, that's not far from me at all.
Okay, so inside the Mugshots bar, I think it's 159th Street, is the little counter, the Original Mr. Beef. He moved inside there. Go there. Go see Carl Buonavolanto III. Tell him Steve sent you. And get a beef sweet hot juicy, and then we should talk.
Welcome back to LevyCast. I'm your host, Dan Levy. With me is NBC5's food guy, Steve Dolinsky. My question is this. Who would you say is the greatest chef you've ever had a meal from?
Oh, boy. Probably Matsuno-san at a restaurant in Kyoto, Japan called Tempura Matsu. And it was not a fancy restaurant at all. It was pretty casual, actually, about 20 minutes outside of Kyoto. And we sat at the counter. And we had, I guess, what you call an omakase, a chef's tasting menu. And it just blew my mind. It's my number one or number two meal of all time.
Wow.
So Matsuno-san, I don't know his last name. His son Toshio was also there. Matsuno-san passed away, but his son Toshio does still work there. In fact, I referred it to one of my colleagues, Mike Gebert, who writes The Fooditor column in Chicago. He and his family were out in Kyoto several years ago, and I turned them on to it, and they did the same. They had the same experience. So that was pretty. I mean, just to give you one example, a block of sort of pinkish toro, fatty tuna belly, right? And they slice a piece off, and then they have this beautiful nori, this dried seaweed they get from a special farm somewhere in Japan, and they're waving it over the Binchotan charcoal, sort of just heating it up to soften it a little bit. And then they're placing the toro in, and they're putting in the rice that they have at perfect room temperature, seasoned with just the right amount of vinegar, and they're rolling it up, and they're handing it to you, and you're eating it a la minute. So you do like, you know, two of those, and then there's a guy holding up a live spiny lobster, and he's like, we're going to make white miso with this spiny lobster. We're going to
be man.
So it's all happening before your eyes. Just incredible.
Unbelievable. And out of all the celebrity chefs that are out there, the Gordon Ramsays, the Bobby Flays, the Emerald, and those guys, the Graham Elliots, who would you, I'm sure you've tried all of them or at least kind of been in around those guys. Which one of them are the better chefs?
I honestly had a great meal at Kraft many years ago from Tom Colicchio. He probably doesn't get as much credit because he's a TV personality now more than he is a chef.
Interesting.
Kraft was, great experience there, I think. Also, he's not really a celebrity chef, but the guy who runs Gramercy Tavern in New York, it's owned by Danny Meyer, who's a kind of a celebrity owner. He's the same guy who started Shake Shack. But Gramercy Tavern was an incredible experience. You know what? I will say, back up. Eric Repair from Le Bernardin in New York City. He's always in the world's top 25 restaurants. He was very good friends with Bourdain, was actually with Bourdain when he killed himself in France. But Eric Repair is a very well-regarded chef, pseudo-celebrity. I mean, he's known among the food industry for sure, probably not the average folks like Emeril is. But one of the best meals of my life also at Le Bernardin. In fact, I just made a reservation. I'm going there in January with my family because we're going to be in New York for a week. That's the priority for me. In fact, when Rich Melman opened L2O in Chicago many years ago, he was trying to model Le Bernardin, really high-end. That was an incredible experience also.
Greatest place to get a hamburger?
In the world or in Chicago?
I'll go both because I have a lot of Chicago listeners and I have a lot of... to me, I've never had a better burger than Au Cheval in Chicago on Randolph. But I've not traveled as much as I should to really go connoisseur action. But that's the best burger I've ever had.
Yeah, I don't eat a ton of burgers around the world, to be honest with you. I will say Au Cheval in Chicago lives up to its hype, without a doubt. I think it's a fantastic burger, everything in proportion. One of the things I talk about in my pizza writing is a term called OBR, optimal bite ratio. And when you get that burger at Au Cheval, you get an OBR, which is important. You know, there's no lettuce, there's no tomato. It's that little brunoise, that fine chop of red onion and mustard and pickle and or relish. It's a perfect burger. And cheese is simple, American cheese. I've had a really good burger in New York. I'm trying to think of the name of the place. And it just escapes me right now. But I'm not a huge burger guy. I tend to go Asian more often than not. But in Chicago, without a doubt, Au Cheval.
Steak? Everybody always measures Peter Luger. Are you a steak guy? Is Peter Luger the place to go? Or are you just not a...
Luger is super overrated, without a doubt. One of the most overrated restaurants I've ever been to. I've been there twice.
Wow.
Went once for dinner, once for lunch. And the stupid dressing they put on is a joke. And the service is awful. The steaks are the same dry-aged steaks you're going to get anywhere in Chicago, any finer restaurant. For me, best steakhouse is Booth House. It's in Ukrainian Village. It's on Western Avenue. They don't get any press because they're not downtown and, you know, on the river. Like all the...
Wow. I used to live over that area. I never heard of it.
Yeah. It's like a 1000 Northwestern. It's Boeuf, B-O-E-U-F, House, H-A-U-S. So French and German. Both chefs classically trained who run the place. Dry aged steaks cooked in cast iron, very much in the French style, basted with butter and garlic and herbs. Yeah, for sure. Boeuf House. If you're downtown, I'd say Bavette's. But if you don't care about being downtown, I'd go to Boeuf House.
If somebody like myself were to come to you and I wasn't from Chicago and I just want the best of the best, what's the best? A perfect day of eating. Breakfast, lunch, dinner. We can go anywhere in Chicago, the suburbs. If I was going to go the perfect of each, where are you sending a guy like me to?
Probably going to do breakfast. It's either going to be dim sum in Chinatown at Dolo or brunch at Lula, which is a hidden gem in Logan Square. It's been there for 20 years, but nobody thinks about going there for brunch. That would be my morning, Lula or Dolo in Chinatown. And then for lunch, if you're going to do a lunch.
I'm doing a lunch.
You're doing a lunch. probably Sochi, a fantastic Vietnamese restaurant in Lakeview. Everything made from scratch, just outstanding, outstanding food. And then dinner, probably Avec. I go to Avec a lot. I've never had a bad meal there. They've got two locations now. And so and you can eat like a king there for $100.
I love any kind of places. I actually, my favorite place is always going to be Fogo. I love those Brazilian steakhouses. I love that I can get any kind of cut. And I know it's frowned upon, but I just love that I can, my wife, you know, she likes a steak a certain way. I like mine a certain way. And I like being saying we can have all of them. I can have all of them.
Okay. I'm just not a fan of quantity over quality. I just
gotcha. Don't think,
just because they give you more doesn't mean it's going
to
be better.
But I've also gotten to a place, and I'll say this for you too. I feel like whenever you go into the upper echelon of steaks, when you go into an upper echelon of pizza, when you go into the upper echelon of any, when you're spending real money, I notice there's only some little differences between, like you said, everything's going to be a dried steak that you can find anywhere in Chicago. Am I going to Gibson's? Am I going to Morton's? Am I going to any of these places, these fancy places? They all, Ruth's Chris, there's not a lot of difference for me. So that's the only reason I like to go to a Fogo. I can get every different kind of steak because there may not be as quality as those high-end ones, but at least I can have different kinds of cuts. And I'm not just stuck to, this is the same ribeye I get at Harry Carey's. This is the same ribeye I can get at, Gina Giorgetti's. I feel like when you get to that, we're dry aging everything, we're wet aging, it's 12-year, 14-year, whatever it is, then I'm like, for me, nothing will stand out except for a guy walking around in a gaucho uniform and slicing it in my face. So for me, that's why I always say to my wife, if we're going to spend the money, let's get everything instead of just one steak for the $60 and then that's it.
But there's also, I mean, there's not just, you know, service is a factor, but also the sides and the desserts and the app. Like, you know, going to a place, trying to think of a good, like Maple and Ash. You know, I've taken out-of-towners to Maple and Ash for steaks. And I mean, the whole menu is solid, not just the steak. So that's kind of a fun experience. And it's not as sort of, it's a little bro-y, it's a little finance bro-y, but there's a real chef behind that menu, Danny Grant. And so it's not, I don't know. How much steak can you eat? That's my thing. You know,
that's it too.
8-9 ounces, like how much can you eat? You want to eat other stuff too.
Well, the younger I was, it became a challenge. that was an adult. Right. You're right. It's shifted in different places. Also, the Italian place. I used to live in Little Italy. I've always found that there's so many really good Italian places. What's your favorite Italian spot to go to?
Not in Little Italy, but probably Monteverde in the West Loop or Piccolo Sogno.
I like it. And when you're deciding to go almost the low, what is your, when you want to just eat and kind of go real Chicago, low end, hot dog place, pizza place. Where's your, I'm going to just gorge out right now.
Well, for a tavern style, Chicago style pizza, I go to Pat's, without a doubt. Pat's have been there for 70 years and that's where I get a sausage jardinera every time.
That's good.
You know, there's some really good sandwich shops now. There's really, to eat well for not very much money, like a place called Tribeca's is good, or Loaf Lounge is good, or JT's sandwich shop, I think it's called, is, you know, there's just some really good casual places you can pick out for like $25. So these are the kinds of stories I cover, you know, for NBC.
I'm always partial to that Conte di Savoia right there in Little Italy by UIC. It's one of the best sandwiches I've ever had. They've never really raised the prices too much, and it's still, every time I send somebody there, they're always like, that might be the best sub I've ever had.
You know what? D'Amato's. I would say
D'Amato's is really good.
Yeah, great bread, great topping, great ingredients, but the fact they bake the bread in their coal-fired oven is a big deal for me.
I would be remiss not to bring up that you also do a podcast with one of the best chefs in the world, in Rick Bayless.
I used to.
Oh, you don't do it anymore?
No, we stopped doing it. During COVID, we just stopped it. It was too hard. It was great. Ran for 4 years.
You should have contacted me. I can do it. I can do everything remote. I can start it back up if you need.
Oh, maybe.
I don't mind doing it.
It was a great run.
Being around Rick Bayless, was he one of those chefs? Could you actually critique a chef like him if you're actually working with him? Can you say, hey, you know what? I did not like that taco I came in with the other night. Or
I could. Yeah. I mean, I've known him long enough and, you know, we can be honest with each other. So, yeah, I mean, but we didn't really talk about his restaurant as much. We tried to talk about other stuff.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I certainly have, we worked together for a long time doing that show. So we would get together like on a Monday and tape 6 shows in a row. So we weren't doing it every week. The show aired every week, but we would do a chunk on a Monday.
Gotcha.
That was his day off. But no, he's very good about taking criticism. He's not, you know, he's not holier than thou.
Because I've had some of his restaurants and a lot of times I like it, but I'm always like, am I liking it because I know of like everybody says I should like this, or is it... I found there's other good Mexican places I've been to, where I'm like, that one seems just as good, if not better, than what I'm eating right here.
Yeah, but I think it's important to go because he was, he first planted the flag here, and you know, the first guy to do regional Mexican cooking in America like that, that level. And I think it's important to go to Topolobampo. I think it's important to have a sandwich at Xoco, you know, just to have that experience.
Those are good. What is the best Mexican? My wife wanted to know what was the best Mexican restaurant in Chicago.
It's hard to say like the best. I mean, it's, you know, I can't say there's one that stands out. I mean, Five Rabanitos is good on 18th Street. You know, La Chaparita I go to for tacos. Topolobampo is certainly the best high-end Mexican, without a doubt.
Gotcha. Well, again, I could do this with you all day long. I guess the next step is I want to go eat with you. So if there's ever a time I can come down and do it and experience what it's like to be with a guy who's as well palated as you are, and count me in. This sounds like I'll pay for myself. I just want to be around and experience exactly the way you would see it and the way you've been finely tuned to it. So count me in.
Sounds like that's a deal. We'll make it happen.
And then afterwards, we'll go back to being kosher and tell everybody that this was just a dream. Yeah. Steve Dolinsky, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Again, I really appreciate your time. I know how busy you are. And like I said, it's anytime I can do a podcast like this where I can just talk about food. And again, I did this podcast without eating because I figured if I eat a full meal, I can't do this. If I eat a full meal, I can't watch the Food Network. I can't watch any of those shows. I'm like, it's too much. I'm already full. I can't even go grocery shopping. So this had to be done on an empty stomach.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. And again, he's on NBC5 here in Chicago. And I think you're pretty much, I mean, all of a sudden you'll watch The Iron Chef and he's on there contributing and other TV shows. So Steve Dolinsky, you can pretty much find him everywhere, but in here in Chicago, NBC5. And if you are interested in taking in some of his coaching and want to be on TV doing this stuff, go to stevedolinsky.com. Is there anything else people want to be able to find you? Do you want to promote anything else?
Well, just pizzacityusa.com. We do tours, you know, in the summertime. And then our big festival's coming up in LA end of April. And then we'll do one in Chicago next August. So pizzacityfest.com.
I want to be a judge. How does one get a judge? I want in.
There's no picking best of anything at that event.
All right, fine. Cut me off of the knees, won't you?
Just appreciating and enjoying pizza and learning about pizza.
Thank you so much. And again, thanks everybody for tuning in to LevyCast. Once again, please tell your friends, share, subscribe, review it, all the good stuff. You can find this podcast on all platforms where you get your podcast. Steve Dolinsky, thank you so much. I'm Dan Levy. This has been LevyCast. We'll see you on the next one. See you, everybody.